listen as the trees sing their songs in the wind. Lyrics and melodies for the spirit's senses, songs of laughter and life, timeless things in timeless places. Do not be afraid to be strong. Do not be afraid to love, but always remember. Always remember. Love wisely, the love of being, free of possession, the love of being beyond desire, the love of being, respect for Mother Earth. Listen as the trees sing their songs in the wind, lyrics and melodies for the spirit's senses. Songs of laughter and life, timeless things in timeless places. Do not be afraid. Remember, the medicine is in the time. Live this life to last. Join the time of tomorrow and the past. Be like us. Serve the creation. We will endure. Listen as the trees sing their songs. Listen. Listen.
John Trudell. And this is Chris. The show is Peace and Justice. We're here with you every Friday with rotating hosts. I am pleased to be with you today, and I have my first guest in the studio since March of 2020, and she is Mary Kay Benson. She's retired from being an administrative manager for nonprofits and volunteers as a community activist working on solutions in environment, managing Chico 350 and 350 Butte County since 2017, and now volunteers for Shelter Crisis Solutions with North State Shelter Team and the Butte County Shelter for All Coalition. She's currently employed with Butte County Local Food Network as an assistant researcher and writer for a baseline food security assessment along with CSU nutrition students and professors. So thank you so much for being with me today, Mary Kay. How are you doing?
Chris, it's an honor to be here.
All right, so we have so much to talk about. I'm going to move my mic. This will make a noise. We have to start off with, well, we were going to start off with the trees, but you didn't want to talk about COVID, so let me just say something to our listeners first, because I feel it is my responsibility to remind us that that COVID is rampant now in Butte County with the Delta variant, which is extremely contagious as chickenpox. Only 40% of our county is vaccinated. There are 25 people hospitalized with COVID on Wednesday, and we have about 46 new cases every day. We have the fifth highest hospitalization in the state. So until you can be vaccinated, listeners, whether you're vaccinated or unvaccinated, it is a good idea to return to wearing a mask, a tight-fitting, tight-woven mask over your face whenever you are in any kind of a setting where you cannot be at least 6 feet away from people, and indoors more like 10, 20, 30, 40 feet from others. So it's very important for you to stay safe during this difficult time. And Mary Kay Benson, you have done so much work, and I know you were up in the Paradise Burn Scar yesterday, and we recognize there's a lot of misdirected anger and a lack of willingness to recognize the heating and change in rain patterns and other weather changes that have linked to the catastrophic climate crisis that we're seeing now expressed in this ravenous Dixie Fire. So I would like you, as Chico 350, to start off our conversation today. And what would you have our listeners know about climate change? And also, to the climate deniers out there, what do we need to be doing?
Well, I don't know how to tell the climate deniers what to do other than get educated, inform thyself. But you know, being up on the burn scar yesterday, working on the food security, all the people up there, I was at First Baptist Church, and all of the people there, the 24 staff members who do the food pantry there, they're so triggered by the New Dixie fire, which went from the 8th largest fire in California history yesterday to today. It's the third largest fire in California history. And they can't even watch the news, but they're so triggered. And, you know, they want to help the people of Greenville now, get them fed, because 1,100 people more lost their homes yesterday, or 2 days ago, in that. So, actually, how I even came to work with the homeless is through the climate crisis solutions. I just feel that there's going to be so many more and more homeless refugees, climate refugees coming, that I just wanted to do everything I could to just help people get prepared for the disasters that we cannot deny now are coming layer upon layer upon layer.
Right, and what you told me about the people in Paradise who remain is their solidarity, their good-heartedness, and their willingness to help the people of Greenville or wherever they can, which I so appreciate. I think that sometimes crisis brings out the very best in us as people.
Yeah, I was saying, you know, it's like the Dickens quote, you know, it's the best of times and the worst of times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, for sure, all the victims, all the volunteers who are fire survivors themselves, many still living in RVs, they want to help other people. Even though they're exhausted from doing this work, they know that, you know, they have to continue. Mm. And so they just keep recharging themselves by helping others.
And how would people get involved? I mean, I know that there's a bill in Congress for an infrastructure bill that will address climate change. At the same time, you know, the Pentagon is getting more money than they asked for. We are having, you know, military spending that is just outrageous. My last guest today will be talking about that a little bit. But can you recommend action regarding this climate bill?
Well, I think that there's several bills coming down the pike, which is all good. The federal one that I was just reading about is introduced by Cori Bush, who was homeless herself. So that's really powerful. And that would be at the federal level to eliminate homelessness by 2025. Now, that's taking action. That's fast action. So let's all try to help her get that through Congress. And then at the state level, I don't know the names or the numbers of the bills, but there's a couple that's before the state legislature now, too. So once again, just trying to educate ourselves and then contact our local representatives or non-representatives, as I call them, but still let them know. Mm-hmm. Try to educate them, try to bring them into the 21st century, and let's get prepared.
Yeah, and I must tell my listeners that Mary Kay Benson is a prolific writer on Facebook, and if you can follow her, you will find out more every day about ways that you can get involved and ways that you can plug in, whether your issue is climate change, food security, or helping unhoused neighbors. We're going to go to a song now, and then and it'll be also from this old release, If a Tree Falls, and I'm going to get Professor Don Hankins on the line. So stay with us here at your community radio station, KZFR.
Parasitic greed head scam. From Sarawak to Amazonas, Costa Rica to mangy BC hills, cortege rhythm of falling timber. What kind of currency grows in these new deserts, these brand new floodplains?
So many trees falling in forests across California, Oregon, British Columbia, you name it. And I have on the line with me Dr. Don Hankins. He combines his academic and cultural interests through applied research of indigenous stewardship practices as a keystone process to aid in conservation and management of resources. He is currently engaged in fire and water research involving indigenous communities in California and Australia. Don Hankins has been involved in various aspects of land management and conservation for a variety of organizations and agencies, including federal and tribal governments. And it's our honor to have him here with us today on occupied Michupta lands. Thank you, Dr. Hankins, for being with me today on KZFR. Hi.
Good morning. Yes. It's my pleasure to be on.
Yeah. The first thing, I'm thinking of our listeners today, and I have Mary Kay Benson in the studio with me, and she said, you should move your third question up to your first, because for our listeners, the most important thing is your advisement about people who might be listening in Cohasset Forest Ranch or other communities, or even down here on the valley floor, about how to maximize their safety in regards to fire risk. Can you address that first?
Yeah, so you're talking about like home hardening and that sort of thing?
Yes, please.
Yeah, so in terms of home hardening, you know, at this point in the game with the Dixie Fire nearby, I would really focus in on the smaller things around the house that create the beds where embers can start fires. So that includes raking and cleaning away from the base of the home. You know, having vegetation, if you have like shrubs against the house, make sure that they're watered and well hydrated. If you have gutters, you know, clean the gutters out and make sure that they're clean and free of debris. You know, anywhere where there might be any kind of organic material that an ember could land in and catch fire, you really want to get that away from the house. That's really the first point. You know, and then in terms of the longer view of things, if you're thinking of other actions for home hardening, there's a lot of really great tools that are there for identifying, you know, like your vent covers and those kind of things that you can find online as recommendations for fire hardening your home. And there's a lot of different things that folks can do to do those sorts of things. I mean, at this point in the game, it's a little bit late to be thinking about those sorts of things, you know, but doing the little things that you can do right now around the house is really important.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I know we're right in the middle of fire season, even though it's fairly early. You know, this Dixie Fire has put us all on edge, and we've never really seen this level of destruction since 2018. You know, but the dryness of the fuel, the heat, the wind, and this terrifying and destructive fire. And your expertise is in indigenous stewardship practices. And I was wondering, how do indigenous stewardship practices, climate awareness, and relate to what is happening now? People are saying that PG&E is at fault, environmentalists are at fault, the governor's at fault. There's so much blame going around. But how should we be grounded into the role that forests play and how to prevent the risk with climate change going forward in terms of your lens of indigenous practices?
Yeah, well, I think in terms of knowing the landscape is really the fundamental piece of that. So when we consider indigenous stewardship of forest lands or grasslands or whatever ecosystem, particularly here within our region, it's about reading the landscape, you know, and knowing what the conditions are in all the different seasons, knowing the different species and how they respond to fire, you know, for instance, like nesting birds or the condition state of trees and, you know, where if it's their growing season or not, you know, that's the fundamental basis for understanding indigenous stewardship with fire in particular. It comes down to knowing those things, reading when it's appropriate to use fire, and then applying fire within those places. And, you know, for indigenous peoples, the use of fire has been removed through policy from the state going back to early Spanish settlement time and has carried forward to present times with, you know, fire suppression policies and, you know, state-sanctioned acts to remove indigenous people from the land and punish people for, severely punish people for using fire. And so, you know, without the presence of fire within the landscape and without reading the landscape in that same way and applying fire in that way, we've really created a situation where we're in today. And the Dixie Fire is burning through, you know, areas currently that haven't had recent fire history in them. You know, we think about where it started at. You know, sure, it was in the footprint of fires from 2008 and the early 2000s. But then, you know, it's been moving into places where we just haven't had fire. And so there's a fuel issue. There's issues with different land tenure and stewardship of those certain lands. And really, it's this kind of deficit of fire and the right season of using fire that has really kind of contributed to this. And then you add to that, you know, the effects of long-term drying that comes about from not only, you know, the current, you know, what people call the drought, right? But this drought has been going on for a long time, and folks who live in the foothills and we're all in this region, you know, connected to groundwater supplies, and people's wells are going dry. Like, these are all indicators of how dry the land is. So, you know, equate that to the trees that are in the forest. You know, those are all things that are those indicators telling us that you know, fire needs to be in these places and is happening, right?
Yeah, it is big time. You know, Dr. Hankins, I have been thinking about the future, and we are going to have this incredible burn scar now from Caribou all the way up to Silver Lake at this point, and it's still, the fire's still moving, of course, but it's going to be huge. And I was wondering, what kind of recovery could, you know, would, if there was a time when you could have controlled this as an indigenous person, you know, from that area, what kind of replanting or restoration could be done in those areas in order to bring back a healthy environment? We've seen all these invasive species filling paradise now that are, you know, you look at it and go, oh, you know, what is the succession plan here? But what can you recommend to people who, you know, who are really despairing about how this is going to seem after it's over?
Right. Well, I think there's a lot of different ways to kind of think about that. One is I'll be curious to see what the fire severity of this fire is across the entirety of the acreage, you know, once it's done, right? Potentially there is going to be seed sources naturally within the landscape. So there's going to be pools of living forest and ecosystems that will recover. They'll be the seed sources for the adjacent areas and so forth. So that's fine, and that's what nature intends. You know, in other areas we have to be thinking about, okay, well, now we've got a different situation where we had forest. Maybe it's, you know, it burned so hot that what's going to naturally want to come back is shrubs. And those shrubs maybe are going to play an important role in fixing nitrogen. For instance, a lot of the ceanothus species, you know, the deer brush and buck brush that we see in the mountains, you know, they're nitrogen fixers, and so they help to fix the soil and heal the soil and make the space for then oaks and other, you know, conifers and so forth to move in. You know, and it takes time. It's not going to be a short time period, but those are going to be important places for that to happen. And then, you know, the other piece of it is thinking, okay, well, some of these places are going to be, have burned so frequently that they convert to grass, and what species of grass are there, and how the grass, particularly in wind events, moves fire very quickly. And so, you know, we think about that. We think about the residual fuel loads and what the risk of future fire is. But ultimately, it comes back to needing to put fire back into these places to help maintain them. And, you know, one of the things that I really advocate for, and this really comes from an indigenous knowledge system, is that, you know, once a system has burned, it, you know, we really need to be using fire as a tool to help maintain it. And so, you know, if it has burned hot now, well, maybe the next opportunity is for us to come in with a cooler fire, you know, in the wintertime, for instance, to help to change, you know, some of the residual fuels that are remaining and help shepherd it in a way that it can recover and be a healthy system in the future.
Okay, so along with that, I we're running out of time, but I think that salvage logging will be a big thing, and I was wondering how the remaining trees that are standing on this land matter to nature, and if you could address that.
Yeah, well, so in terms of the trees that remain, you know, the, or even, you know, the dead trees that are standing in the forest, there's a couple of things that stand out in importance to me around that. One is how they influence the wind. And so when we come in and remove all of those trees, you know, all the snags that are there, it changes the wind pattern. You know, obviously the fire itself defoliating the trees is going to change the wind pattern, but we have to think about how those wind, like the surface winds in particular, ultimately, if we remove all those snags, how fast is fire going to move through next time when like there's a north wind event, for instance? Mm-hmm. So we need to be thinking about that. We also need to be thinking about habitat and what the value of that is. But at the same time, there's a question of, well, how much is the right amount? And, you know, not knowing what the aftermath of this fire in particular is at this point, that's going to be hard to come up with that. But there are certainly species that are going to benefit from the snags. And you know, and that includes, you know, different insects, different cavity nesting birds, for instance. But then there's, you know, the other species that have lost out because of it. So, you know, there's this balance that we need to be aware of, and you know, ultimately it comes again back to using the right kind of fire to steward for all of those species, you know, and not to create this imbalance where we have a landscape that's dominated by high severity fires, which unfortunately I think is what we're starting to head towards, you know, and that's not a very bright looking future for our region if that's what happens.
No, it doesn't look bright. But Dr. Hankins, I really appreciate the fact that you spent the time with us today. My last question is about resources for people who want to learn more about indigenous practices and, you know, how we can get the state of California and Cal Fire to apply them.
Right. Well, there's a lot of good resources, I would say, for people who are just generally interested in indigenous stewardship. Kat Anderson's book, Tending the Wild, from what I think it was 2005, is a really good resource for just a general overview of what indigenous stewardship is. There's also a lot of tribes that are starting to reengage around indigenous stewardship, particularly with fire. And if you kind of look around to different regions, you know, locally, there's some efforts with folks from Machupta. There's work up on the Klamath River with Yurok and Karuk tribe, Amamutsen, for instance, down in the Bay Area. And even up in the footprint of this fire, the Maidu Summit Consortium are all engaged in these kind of activities. Unfortunately, you know, I think the scale of a lot of it is just not to where it would make the difference at this point. But, you know, in time, we'll get there. So I think those are good starting points. And I think the one kind of encouragement I guess I would offer to listeners is that the state is currently taking action to and planning for the incorporation of indigenous stewardship back into these landscapes. And, you know, the governor's action plan that was released in January includes plans that do talk about providing the space for indigenous stewardship. And, you know, there's funding now that's starting to you know, come through legislation, you know, bills and so forth, and even legislation itself that addresses indigenous stewardship in this legislative session. So, you know, while it's a little, maybe a little bit too late in some respects, it's at least a step in the right direction. I'm hopeful that, you know, we can start to scale things to avoid the kind of situations that we're currently facing.
Thank you, Dr. Hankins, for being with me on the Peace and Justice program today. I appreciate your knowledge and the fact that you are in our environment to help us, guide us forward. Thank you.
My pleasure. All right. A good day.
You too. Bye. All right. I have in the studio with me Mary Kay Benson, and she's been listening to Dr. Hankins. And I was wondering, Mary Kay, if you wanted to, before we go to break, if you would like to give your reflections about anything that he said. I thought it was very amazing to just hear him.
Absolutely, every time. And I could listen to him all day. And I have. Him and Allie Metters-Knight, you know, often tag team. And she does the TEK, Traditional Ecological Knowledge, here. So between the two of them, I have learned what little I know and will study for the rest of my life.
And so the TEK, can you just tell people, I know you go to Verbena Fields on Fridays, but how do people get involved in that if they want to learn from a master?
Yeah, so if you want to have hands-on workshop experience, Allie's there during the summer. She starts at 9:30 and goes till about 12:30. In when it gets cooler, she goes from 10 to 1, and she always has a flock of helpers. I can't go when it's super hot like this, but I went in the spring, and I will be returning as soon as the weather allows. But you just learn hands-on. We trim willow, we cut it, people weave it into fences for the water control directions in the watershed there. It's supposed to be a watershed. And you learn. We learn the medicinal plants that are also edible. We just learn the philosophy of the indigenous land management, because they successfully managed the land, unlike us, for thousands of years, and they really know what they're doing, and we can learn it too, and we're welcome.
Thank you, Mary Kay. I really appreciate that. It is coming up to the top of the hour. I just want to thank our underwriters here at KZFR. We depend on you, the listeners, as well as our underwriters. And I'd like to thank first Chico Natural Foods Cooperative, offering a variety of organic and local produce, organic groceries, and supplements. The co-op has hot food, ready-to-eat sandwiches, and cold brew coffee. The co-op now accepts online orders for curbside pickup. Chico Natural Foods Co-op, open every day on the corner of 8th and Main in downtown Chico. And also like to thank Chico Velo, supporting bicycling, education, and advocacy since 1980. Chico Velo encourages you to ride your bicycle and park it safely at their bike valet when available at the Thursday night market and the Saturday farmers market. For more information, visit chicovelo.org and find them on Facebook. I'd also like to thank the Regional and Continuing Education at Chico State, offering online graduate test preparation courses for those seeking an advanced degree in a wide range of fields, including law and business. Sign up for a complimentary strategy session to help you prepare to take the GRE, the GMAT, and the LSAT at rce.csuchico.edu. Also, lastly, would like to thank Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, family-owned, operated, and argued over since 1980, reminding their listeners to think for themselves but drink with others. It is just about noon straight up. This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And I would like to make sure you know that the opinions voiced on the program do not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of KZFR staff, volunteers, board of directors, or underwriters. They are my own and my guests. And I want to go to another song just for a second so we can kind of shift our minds into our next topic area, which is going to be houselessness and our city council and what we can do in our community to make our community better. And Mary Kay Benson is with me, and she is going to give you lots of information, and we all need information. So let's keep it going here at KZFR Community Radio.
No one would like to admit that there is a city underground. People live every day off the waste and decay, off the disguise of their fellow man. Here in Sub-City, life is hard. We can't receive any government relief. Won't you please give the president my honest regards for this regarding me. There's too much crime in these streets. My sentiments exactly. Government and big business hold the purse strings. When I worked for the back ends. I'm at the mercy of the world. Guess I'm lucky to be alive. 'Cause here in South City, life is hard. We can't receive any government. Mr. President, my honest regards for this regarding me. They say we're falling through the cracks. They say the system works, but we won't let it help. Guess they never stop to think we might just want handouts. Way to make an honest living.
So listeners, what do you think? I would love to know who you are and what you think. But at this point, I'm just going to let Mary Kay go with this topic pretty much. Mary Kay, again, Mary Kay Benson is working with a number of organizations, Chico 350 on the environment. She volunteers for North State Shelter Team and the Butte County Shelter for All Coalition. And she's employed with the Butte County Local Food Network. And Mary Kay, thanks again for being with me today on the Peace and Justice Program. We have so much to talk about in this next half hour. And we wanted to talk about the City Council meeting that took place on Tuesday. And I just hope our listeners are kind of up to speed, because we've covered homelessness a lot here on this program and others here on KZFR. Guillermo Mash, Sue Hildebrand, we've often covered it. But we want to keep people up to date on it, because it's so important. Yeah. I want to refer our listeners first off to the Real Issues program from Wednesday evening at 6 o'clock. And whenever you're trying to find an archive on KZFR because you missed the show, you go to kzfr.org, you click on the program tab, the day of the week, and then scroll down to the time of the show that you're interested in. And that was an important show with City Council member Alex Brown and Stand Up for Chico's Angela McLaughlin. So I do refer people back to that for more background on what we're talking about.
Yeah, I think Alex has proven herself to be quite the shero.
Yes, she is a shero. So there's over 10 million homeless people in the U.S., and currently that's 0.2% of the population, and it is rising. And so we know as problem solvers that we have to do something about it, and yet locally we have a bit of a problem. How would you define our problem?
Ideology.
Okay, can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, we have, we have a 6-1 supermajority on the city council right now, and really the same at the county level. So those of us who advocate for a lot of homeless solutions, we get stymied a lot because we submit proposals for shelter sites. We propose all kinds of different ways that we can help shelter people. Shelter first is my motto. From car parking, safe car parking, to micro shelters like the Conestoga huts, which were like the old covered wagons, except they're not on wheels this time, they're on pallets. And, you know, tiny houses and on up the spectrum to make sure that we replace those 15,000 homes that were lost in the 2018 Camp Fire. And, you know, 900 of those were lost in the Bear Fire. And here in Greenville, we lost 1,100 more houses. So when the city council pretends that we don't need to build shelters, they're, you know, just stuck in ideology.
Hmm. And I do want to, you know, let our listeners know that there have been positive work done from the
Absolutely.
Housing Now model, and Chico Housing Action Team is currently housing 174 formerly homeless individuals successfully, and Everhart Village, which will house people with mental illness, will house about 20 people when that's completed in the fall. Uh-huh. So, and these will be tiny houses. Finally,
yes.
We'll have a little tiny house village.
Yes.
We're seeing all over the country, like in Denver yesterday, I was reading that they are being successful with housing homeless people.
Yeah.
And it can be done. But there
it
has
is being done.
It is being done. And political will is the only thing we're lacking.
Exactly.
But to have political will first, as you say, you have to have an ideology or an understanding. And first, beyond that, you have to admit that unhoused people are people.
Human beings.
Human beings. And so I think this is where we're having a problem, because
exactly.
That is not acknowledged by the majority of our city council. And now it's a super majority. So it's really unfortunate. We had two people appointed, two conservatives appointed to the seats that were formerly held by Scott Huber and Cammie Denley. Can you talk about those two people at all?
Well, I mean, I had written and to the city council and sent it to the Chico ER, and they published it, which was my take on the conflicts of interest within the city council. We know, for example, that Chief Mike O'Brien, ex-chief, he's now the Butte County Law Enforcement on Drugs czar, so to speak. And so anything to do with homeless and drugs, he should recuse himself.
Mm.
Just like Casey Reynolds, we asked her to recuse herself about anything concerning Point of Contact Chico, because she has been heavily involved with them and lobbied to get them their no-bid contract at Butte County for $9,000, which they were awarded with absolutely no experience in another startup. And only because we raised a ruckus did they add a social worker to their team.
Hmm.
So, and beyond that, Casey Reynolds had formed a nonprofit called Verum Communities, Inc., I think, something like that. Anyway, Verum means truth in Latin. And spent about $50,000, I was told, and then she transferred that over to Point of Contact. So anything to do with them, which they are now up for another almost $50,000 no-bid contract. She did recuse herself the other night, and I do applaud her for that. But we had to bring those things to their attention.
You know, I wanted to have people hear what you read at the city council the other day. It's funny, and it's supposedly aimed at Christians, and I think that, not to beat a dead horse, but it's very important to hear these words. And please speak up a little bit.
Sure, thank you. So I was just using the tool of satire because, and also I am a very spiritual person myself. I really believe in these teachings. So I really am tired of the hypocrisy of people who proclaim that they are quote unquote Christians and then do nothing to love thy neighbor. So, so I just used satire as a way to address the city council the other night. So I said, "Greetings, council. First, let me do the land acknowledgement that this council should do before each meeting, that we are guests on occupied, unceded Michupta tribal territory. Second, I would like to join the untested, unproven groups getting nearly $50,000 each from this city council for non-solutions tonight. My new startup organization... my phone just went dead. my new startup organization will be called Hope Floats, Bid Point of No Bid Contracts, Chico. My qualifications are, I am also a partisan coalition of one, operating under a new facade, with my hand out for free taxpayers' money too, just like some of the others on the agenda later tonight. Unlike others, though, my plan does not block the $22 million of federal money on your table, because I do follow the approved federal program adopted since President Bush called Housing First. Third, I will spend the just under $50,000 you give me tonight to buy 10 micro shelters on sale on Wayfair.com right now for Riverside 10x14 foot shelters for $4,699 each. Then I will beg the Michupta sovereign government to put those shelters on their territory. I will now read my mission statement, which I lifted from a previously published book. Oh Lord, you hear the desire of the afflicted. You will strengthen their heart. You will incline your ear. Psalm 10:17. If among you one of your brothers should become poor in any of your towns within your land that the Lord your God is giving you, you shall not harden your heart or shut your hand against your poor brother. Deuteronomy 15:7. For there will never cease to be poor in the land. Therefore I command you, you shall open wide your hand to your brother, to the needy and to the poor in your land. Deuteronomy 15:11. If your brother becomes poor and cannot maintain himself with you, you shall support him as though he were a stranger and a sojourner, and he shall live with you. Take no interest from him or profit, but fear your God that your brother may live beside you. Leviticus 25:35-36. And the king will answer them, truly I say to you, as you did it to one of the least of these my brothers, you did it to me. Matthew 25:40. If you pour yourself out for the hungry and satisfy the desire of the afflicted, then shall your light rise in the darkness and your gloom be as the noonday. Isaiah 58:10. Thank you.
So that's quite a few references. And, another poignant part of the meeting, which I watched online, was when Nancy Parks read the names of all the people that have, well, not all the people, but the people we know about, exactly, who have died in the last 2 years, yeah, unhoused. And, of course, we unfortunately learned about new people as a result of that reading. But the city council did not acknowledge it in any way.
Never has.
Never have. And so let's move on and talk about Hope Street Coalition, because in the beginning of your satire, you were addressing these no-bid contracts. And I think our listeners might know that if a contract is $50,000 or above, it has to go out to bid. And so the city of Chico was awarded a contract to something called the Hope Street Coalition for $49,950. And can you talk about them, Mary Kay Benson?
Yeah, so I've done a little research, and I just looked online at Paul Webster's LinkedIn resume and found out that, first of all, he was with HUD for 1 year and 2 months. And keep promoting his HUD credentials as if it's the be-all, end-all, and in fact, the longest he has ever worked at any organization was this nonprofit that got their HUD funding taken away from them because of their stance against shelter. They don't follow the Housing First model, which was installed by President Bush. So what their plan is to basically incarcerate people and force them into drug treatment and the mentally ill to be put in some kind of beds. Well, one of my biggest problems with all of that is it's the beds that we're lacking, no matter whether they're mentally illness beds or drug addiction beds, and much less shelter beds. So the whole idea that you're saying don't build shelters, stick them in treatment first, flies against, you know, all of the science and wisdom and policy that, you know. And you can't, any group that promotes those ideas will lose the federal funding, not only for their project, but for other people's projects. And then, of course, their projects would take away money from other actually locally proven, tried and true, tested organizations that actually do help, you know, on all the services. So, yeah, so it's just a model that we not only eschew, but we directly work against that. You know, for us, it's shelter first, and then you deal with people's problems one by one with caseworkers. You know, we need more social workers. Not as many police, more social workers, please. That's, you know, that's kind of my take on it.
Right. Yeah, I was thinking about when we were walking over here, the tension in the plaza. Someone was yelling and throwing things around, and the smoke was thick and heavy, and the heat was bearing down. And how could anybody be in recovery in that setting? It's not possible.
Right.
You can't recover in a setting like that.
Right.
And
it takes months and months and months.
Yeah, you can't even,
if not years.
I mean, you know, I couldn't do it. I mean, I don't know anybody who could. But anyway, I did offer the only employee for Hope Street Coalition that we have been able to find out about is Paul Webster, the director. And I did reach out to him, and he said that he would come on the Peace and Justice program once the contract with the city is cemented. And so we'll get to hear his side of who he is and what he does. But they now are going to be receiving this money rather than having a homeless solutions coordinator position in the city of Chico.
Yeah.
This will be the person, and he's from San Diego, doesn't know the community, doesn't know any of the resources or the advocates or the people who, and the people where they're staying, you know.
And it's a startup company. It's 7 months old. He has had no contracts. We would be his first. I think I heard Alex Brown call us the guinea pigs for his bright idea, which, you know, is really just, I think, self-enriching.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's not going to provide any shelter. He's not going to provide any service. He's going to provide a consulting report. Whoopee.
Yeah, and it's not going to help anyone. It's just shuffling papers, basically.
It's throwing away taxpayers' money.
Right, exactly.
For non-solutions.
And meanwhile, the other thing that happened on Tuesday night was Vince Ewing, the L.A. lawyer who represents the city of Chico and has brought us many lawsuits now, has tightened up the anti-camping ordinances. Can you talk about...
Well, he hasn't tightened them up. He's playing word games to try to pass the minimum appeasement for the federal judge. The judge has said your ordinances are unconstitutional and circular. There's about four of them. And what they do is, according to the judge, in his own words, I'm paraphrasing, but he said, your ordinances would require that our homeless population be on their feet moving 24 hours a day and not have any possessions on them. And that is federally unconstitutional. And so instead of actually, now Vince Ewing wrote these ordinances back when, in 2013 to 2018, I believe, but don't quote me on that, but in that time range. And they were geared to sort of try to make downtown Disneyland so that there would be no mess and no unsightly blight of, you know, human suffering. And if we could just eliminate those darn people, you know, we could live in Disneyland and it would be back to the 1950s, and wouldn't that be fun? And instead, what we're getting is no help. All of the care that's going to the homeless right now is basically from volunteers. The volunteers have tried to put porta-potties into, say, Tuckert Ponds and trash bins and that kind of thing. We will pay for it. The city will not allow us to do it. We do all the cleanups on Sunday at North State Shelter Team. Charles takes a crew out there every Sunday and takes at least one load of trash to the city trash dumps. And it's just amazing. And then social workers are out there on their own time feeding people. I know you do. It's just abominable. You know, the every time I go out to Comanche Creek, for example, the trash bins that the city provides are smaller. They keep taking them away. We put pressure on them. They restore them to their original size. Mm-hmm. Next time I go out, they're small again. You know, it's just like kind of this insane game we're playing.
Yeah.
You
know? It does feel like that sometimes, but... Before we talk about, you started to move into what you're doing and what we're doing and what I want to get to, what we can all be doing, because this really needs all of us to pitch in.
Amen.
The only way we're going to feel okay about the status of our city is if we all chip in and help. And
yes,
we can lift these boats until we get the next election. We can get these people out. But I just wanted to say this about this Ninth Circuit judge ruling. It's based on the Eighth Amendment rights of homeless citizens. It's the prohibition of cruel and unusual punishment, which directly forbids communities from criminalizing certain aspects of homelessness.
Yep.
When cities prohibit life-sustaining conduct, which is the ability to sleep, they present people with an unconstitutional mandate: follow the law and die, or stay alive and risk arrest.
Absolutely.
And that's what it boils down to.
Yeah, so the wordsmithing is basically to get back to, can we start arresting people again, please, Judge?
Mm-hmm.
And Judge says, nope.
Yeah. And the only other thing I wanted to add before we talk about ourselves as the best resources is that the airport site is still active at last count. There were 5 RVs there and 2 tents. And Casey Reynolds said, I believe she said it at council meeting, if not in a YouTube interview I heard her on, that people are using the airport. And just want to remind our listeners that the temperature was measured at 151 degrees on the tarmac there. So it is not a valid solution, just in case any of our listeners had heard otherwise.
And on the positive side, if the city wants to turn that into an RV park where people can be self-sustained with their own air conditioning, we will allow that to be on our list of sites. Sure, no problem, you know, as an RV parking lot.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we have barely 3 minutes left, and I'd like you to tell us all the myriad of things that people can get involved in.
Well, like I've already plugged North State Shelter Team, I've already plugged, which is every Sunday from, well, this Sunday it's going to be at 10:30 a.m. You can go out for an hour and just, we'll provide you with buckets or plastic bags or trash bags and a grabber, and you can go and help us pick up the trash that even most of, I clean up the front because it's by the street and I want people to know that it's being cared for. And a lot of it's just the wind blowing trash up against the fence, you know. So, and we all do that on, lots of people go out Sundays
Creek.
At Comanche Creek.
Right.
Just go to the end of Park Street, the parking lot there, and join in. You'll see Charles's truck with the biodiesel on it. You can't really miss it. And other people are joining. And he actually pays some of our homeless brothers and sisters who, you know, want to earn a little extra money and are happy to help clean up the park as well. And it was really neat that, you know, the judge, I guess yesterday came, the magistrate judge who's doing the mediation, and he came with legal services and the target team and visited Comanche. And so we're really proud that last Sunday, you know, we took like, that was our 20th load, and by just North State Shelter Team, but three or four other pickup trucks came, so we actually took four truckloads of trash out of there last Sunday. But normally, when it's cooler, he does this at 1:20. But you know, you can check on North State Shelter Team on the Facebook and make sure that what time it's going to be every Sunday. But then beyond that, you know, CHAT is always looking for volunteers, and of course they're the ones that are providing the only tiny houses, and really the only permanent shelters that we've got going right now are through CHAT, so yay to them. And then, you know, like I mentioned, tekchico.org is Allie Matters Knight. You can go and work with her. They also do the last walks with the Master Gardeners and with CSU Chico the last Tuesday of every month. That's a two-hour walk at 4 p.m. through Verbena Fields. And once again, you learn a lot. You may also be collecting and distributing seeds. You're going to learn which native plants are in bloom at this time of year. Each time you go, it's slightly different, so it's really fun to see. And, you know, these are all fire-resistant plants, so this is the way that the natives managed the landscape. So those are some of the things.
And I wanted to add,
Safe
Space, do you want to mention them?
Safe Space has cooling centers, okay. And they're looking for volunteers too, and this would be from 2 to 8 p.m. when they're operating, and go to Safe Space and check out. They'll probably be moving locations soon. And we don't promote where because we want to protect our people, but you can find out where easily enough. And you can sign up for like a 2-3 hour shift and just be there helping the folks as they get settled in to cool down.
And if your thing is food, there is the Hunger Trolley, and that is to look up Elizabeth Bogart on Facebook. Chico Friends of the Street serves coffee on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 9 o'clock by, I believe, in the plaza. And
yep.
And also they serve a noon meal on Sundays. I'm looking at Mary-Kate,
yes,
to make sure I'm right on this.
Yes.
And so there's lots of ways, if you're a food person, that you can get involved.
Yeah, so you can just bring, you know, one item or clothing. They'll take any kind of, you know, hygiene items, et cetera, on Sundays at noon in the plaza. And then I also want to mention that Butte County Shelter for All is doing another water drive next weekend, and that one will start at 10 a.m. to 11 a.m., and you can just drop off water, ice, coolers, and the baby wipes that people can use in lieu of showers. Although the North State Shelter Team is building a mobile shower unit, we're about a month away from bringing showers to the people where they're at. But in the meantime, water, baby wipes, ice, and ice coolers can be dropped off at the Hands next Saturday, 10 to 11 a.m.
Thank you so much, Mary Kay Benson, for all of your work. We at KZFR really appreciate you, and keep up the good work.
Oh, thanks, and Chris. You too. And who doesn't love KZFR? You know, people-powered radio.
Yeah, exactly. So we're going to go to a break, and then I'm going to get our next guest up, and thank you for being with us today. Support KZFR, tip of the show if you care to, on our website, and stay tuned. Just one second here. This is a CD, Emily Barker, A Dark Murmuration of Words.
Hello to an angel. We are yet to know. Your father and your mother hope that you will show. But these times are troubled. I'll be honest with you now.
Each other, and we need people not just here in our own town or in our region or in our state, but in our country and in our world. And I am going to be speaking with somebody who is on the other side of this continent. I have on the line with me Alan Hester. He is the legislative representative for nuclear disarmament and Pentagon spending. He leads the Friends Committee on National Legislation's nuclear disarmament and Pentagon spending portfolio. He develops legislative strategies and lobbies Congress for reductions in Pentagon spending, strengthened arms control regimes, and the eventual elimination of nuclear weapons. Ellen Hester is committed to a world free of war and the threat of war and is passionate about shrinking nuclear arsenals. His work at Friends Committee on National Legislation builds on his experience at Physicians for Social Responsibility, where he built grassroots engagement with health professionals who could speak to the medical consequences of nuclear war. At Physicians for Social Responsibility, he also made nuclear weapons spending reductions a key plank of the wider fight to reduce bloated Pentagon spending. He seeks to improve the accessibility and transparency of nuclear weapons and Pentagon spending issues by linking them to themes of justice, human rights, climate change, and imperialism, and by framing budget choices as a reflection of our nation's values. Ellen Hester, welcome to the Peace and Justice Program.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Yeah, you know, this is a poignant day for those of us who are peace activists. This is the 76th anniversary of the destruction of Hiroshima by the United States, the only time that nuclear weapons were purposely used against civilian populations. And I know this has affected you deeply from an article I read that you wrote called "The World Does Not Need More Nuclear Weapons, Remembering Hiroshima and Nagasaki." Can you talk about how that influenced you?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, again, before I jump into my own story, I'd like to take this time for those who are interested in the history and the stories of those who survived and lived and witnessed what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I would want to plug nuclearvoices.org. This is a really amazing project that was created by my colleague Lily Adams from Union of Concerned Scientists. And it seeks to foster collaboration between nuclear frontline communities and those of us who work on the nuclear policy and arms control space. And there you'll be able to find links to groups and individuals who are seeking justice for the harms caused by nuclear weapons production, testing, and use. And it really includes some amazing written testimonies from Hibakusha, the Japanese survivors of the A-bomb attacks. But from my own side, my own influence with this history, I really think it was learning about the effects of the attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki that really contextualized what working on nuclear weapons was all about. I come from a background, my education is in peace and security studies, and I had a really specific interest in atrocity prevention and how do we prevent genocides. And as soon as I really got into the stories of what happened with Hiroshima and Nagasaki, it just became so clear that there was a link with that frame into this work on nuclear weapons policy, and a recognition that these really are, I think as Ray in a previous one of your radio shows said, you know, these really are genocide machines. And I think what really brought it home for me after hearing these stories of what survivors have went through, it's not hard for me to picture their reality of what they saw on those days in my own hometown, because I grew up in Cheyenne, Wyoming, which is right next to Warren Air Force Base, where there are intercontinental ballistic missiles being housed there, you know, and it was very common knowledge that they were there. I mean, with big missiles on display, you know, Mach missiles on display outside as you were driving by the base. So the reality that my hometown, in the event of a nuclear war, would be an obvious attack spot or target in the event of us going to war with a nuclear-armed peer, really hit home for me, and I think brought a lot of these horrible stories and horrible experiences that happened in Japan. You know, it's not hard for me to envision those same stories happening in my hometown.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you brought up the fact that I interviewed Ray Atchison from the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom and the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, and they explained how the countries of the world rejected the deterrence model and worked for a ban on nuclear weapons, and nuclear weapons did become illegal under international law as a result of this international effort in January. You wrote an article, before we talk about that, in this article that you wrote, Why Congress mm-hmm. Keeps Giving the Pentagon More Money Than It Needs, mm-hmm. I wanted you to address both things, the obscene amount of money, taxpayers' money that goes toward the Pentagon, especially in this budget cycle, this mm-hmm. last month, but also this whole idea of deterrence and the dominance theory that is even more deterrence pulling us closer and closer to nuclear annihilation. We're not going to get to our ban if we don't heed this.
Right. So, I think with the first question about Pentagon spending, I mean, yeah, it's outlandish the amount of money of taxpayer dollars that are going towards war, right? And the idea of being prepared for war, which stands at complete odds with what, you know, President Biden himself has said, which is, you know, agreeing with Russian President Vladimir Putin that a nuclear war can never be fought and never be won, right? So the idea that we say that publicly on the international stage, and yet our own defense budget, you know, backs up a completely different story. Our own nuclear posturing backs up a completely different story. And indeed, our idea of deterrence. So, you know, this budget cycle, we're looking at the president putting forward a budget of $715 billion for defense spending. Now, just to keep that in mind, that's not including the spending that's happening on the nuclear weapons side, right? This is just money for the Pentagon. It's already being set at $715 billion by the president. And then when it goes to Congress, it meets a bipartisan consensus, at least in the Senate, that money isn't enough, right? That there's this rhetoric that says, no, we actually need to increase it even more. And the pitch on the Senate side has been, we need to increase it to $740 billion, which is just a tremendous amount of money, especially considering that you've had this rhetoric from the president that says he wants to reduce the role of nuclear weapons in national security, and that he wants to acknowledge that a war with a nuclear peer cannot be won. So it's a very confusing time with this budget cycle, and especially with this new administration stating what it thinks needs to be done, but the pressure that's being applied to this administration from Congress is revolved around our theories of deterrence. And the United States theories of deterrence, one, has two different interpretations. I think the first interpretation of deterrence that you've seen Representative Adam Smith from Washington say this, you know, we need to do what we have to do to make sure that an adversary doesn't think it's a good idea to attack the United States, right? That's the core belief of deterrence. And if you look at that statement, we could have a really honest conversation about, well, then what would we need at a minimum to make an adversary think that attacking the United States isn't a good idea? And you and I could have a discussion about what should we spend money on? What should we cut? What's really needed? You know, what's changing, you know, in the world today, whether it be cyber war becoming more prevalent? You know, what technology do we need to invest in? However, there's a completely other interpretation of deterrence, which basically says, the United States needs to be prepared to fight every one of our adversaries in the world all at the same time across every domain. And if that's your definition of deterrence, which I call the dominance model of deterrence, then there's really no upward ceiling when it comes to what we should or shouldn't spend on, right? The idea would be that we should spend as much as possible on national defense because it covers this wider range of areas. And if you use that frame, every piece of military equipment, every piece of military infrastructure, you know, it could all be called vital in the name of national security. And if that's the lens you're using on deterrence, then it becomes incredibly hard for advocates to start pointing out what we think should be cut from the massive Pentagon budget, because it can just be framed as, you know, wanting to cut something that's urgent or vital to national security. And indeed, I think that's what we're seeing happening in Congress right now. You're seeing Congress start to apply this wide definition of what's vital to deterrence to the whole of the Pentagon budget. And when they do that, it becomes so hard for advocates to go into offices, talk with their congresspeople about where would we like to save money on the Pentagon budget? Where would we like to save money when it comes to the weapons that we're building? Because all of those congresspeople are afraid of being painted as weak on national defense. And it is a constant talking point when we talk about the national defense budget. So we really have to work on some baseline assumptions of what keeps us safe to make progress on this issue.
Yeah. Oh, boy. You know, Alex, Alan Hester, I was just looking through this article as you were speaking and just hearing what you were saying with this maximum, you know, that going to war in every direction, where the state of the world as it is, endless wars, trillions in unnecessary millions, military spending, massive increases in greenhouse gas emissions, incalculable human harm. And what would be your solution to how would you reject this dominance model?
Right. Well, this is a good question. And I guess what I would start off with is, I think that the rejection has started to some degree, right? But it is an incredibly uphill climb. And I mean that by saying there is a movement, I think, across the country and indeed reflected in Washington, D.C. now, you know, even within the policy community that works on foreign policy, of saying, what can we learn from the last, you know, I would say especially what can we learn from our post-9/11 reaction of engaging in the world, right? And the numerous ways that we now can look back with 2020 vision and see the ways in which our response to that caused a lot of harm, and I think caused a lot of unintended consequences when it comes to our engagement in the world. And I think what you're seeing in the policy space now is more and more people, especially from the generation that was raised in that environment, coming out and being critical of the decisions that were made, and starting to say that the restraint point of view on foreign policy, the idea that we shouldn't get engaged in every single crisis in the world, right? Or that we should at least think about the consequences of our engagement in multiple crises across the world. We need to start rethinking that and being more critical of our decisions to get engaged in those issues, because we've seen the negative consequences when we rush towards engaging in parts of the world that are usually harmed by our engagement more than helped. And I think at first that's, and currently in this current moment, is being met with a lot of resistance by foreign policy, you know, establishment that says this is the way that the United States operates in the world. You know, we have to stay strong. We have to appear strong, you know, especially as there are other countries in the world that seem to be growing in strength, right? That the way that we maintain our power is through a dominance, you know, and I think as Ray said so well, you know, this patriarchal assumption, right, of our place in the world as the good guy, right, that goes in and saves the rest of the world from itself.
Right.
It needs to be challenged at that level. And I think what that means is you're seeing entities across the grassroots space and the policy space to say enough is enough. We have enough justification to rethink how we should operate in the world, and you can't just blow us off anymore because we're not hardliners, right? Which I think has been the tradition, especially in Washington, D.C., to blow off criticisms of that model of operating in the world.
So meanwhile, the Congress is going to be voting soon on some new nuclear weapon systems, including upgrades of land-based missiles and new nuclear tip missiles for submarines. Mm-hmm. And this, will, of course, increases the likelihood of nuclear war and definitely increases an arms race among the countries that have nuclear weapons. What can people do, I mean, to support your efforts in Washington or others who are working on this? How do they learn more and get involved?
So I think the number one thing is to not be intimidated by the work. I think this is one of the biggest challenges that this particular area of advocacy and of policy, this is one of the challenges we face, which is, you know, we want to engage the next generation on why these issues are important and on why these issues need to be fought with the same vigor that we're seeing in the climate crisis advocacy, right, that's happening right now, and I think also in the race relations advocacy that we're seeing in the country right now, because those issues are fundamentally impacting people's lives right now in this moment. It's very connected to what they're seeing and experiencing every day. And I think we need to do a better job at presenting this issue in a context that does connect with people's lives. And I think part of the challenge has been, when we talk about nuclear weapons, one of the first images that comes to my mind, and I think the mind of many other people, is this black and white image of a mushroom cloud, right? That I think paints this issue as an issue of the past, right? And what's so amazing about days like the anniversaries that commemorate Hiroshima and Nagasaki is that those are the days that I feel like the stories of the survivors really get uplifted. The stories of people who lived through the Cold War really get uplifted. And it becomes an issue that is connected to human experience rather than an issue that is barred away in international relations policy or, you know, wonky technical language that's used in D.C. It really brings this to a human perspective. And I think we need to continue being advocates of this issue from that perspective, right? What are the consequences to human beings if nuclear war breaks out? And that is a bit, it may seem obvious, but that is not what the policymakers in D.C. are talking about often. Most of the time, the Department of Defense and the policymakers in D.C. are talking about nuclear war from the perspective of what critical infrastructure would we have to attack if we went to war with an adversary? And they aren't even considering the human tolls of those attacks, right? They're thinking about what is the ability for my adversary to produce the things it needs to wage war on me. And then they ask questions later about the casualty rate. So we as advocates need to talk about this issue from a human perspective and talk about the human consequences, talk about the death toll. At the same time, I think we need to be saying, what does a world without nuclear weapons look like? What is the potential there? Because right now, what nuclear weapons have inherently done to the nuclear weapon states that own them is create so much distrust between all of them, right? The amount of distrust today between the nuclear armed states is incredible. And obviously that distrust stems from a place that says the moves that you're making in your country that you say are domestic, right? So for example, China, you know, is getting more, there's evidence that China is growing its nuclear stockpile and its nuclear arsenal. And it says that those moves are in a defensive posturing, right? That it wants to defend itself from adversaries. It wants to increase its deterrence. But obviously, if you're an adversary to China, you read that move as some kind of hostility. And you take it as, I think, the Cold War model, which is we have to assume that China is getting ready to do some kind of attack out of the blue, which is exactly where Russia and the U.S. found each other, you know, years ago. Mm-hmm. So we have to be able to talk about these issues in a way that is removed from that old Cold War perspective. And we have to be loud about the humanitarian consequences of what happens if Washington and other nuclear-armed states think that they can win a nuclear war.
Mm, yeah, exactly. And I think with China, you know, there's more threat from cyber warfare and supply chain attack than anything else. I mean, they basically control our economy. So I really don't know where the United States is going with this Cold War thinking, because it doesn't make any sense.
Yep.
So I wanted to ask you about this letter that was sent to President Biden by 23 members of Congress urging him to reject a 21st century arms race and to make bold decisions to lead us toward a future where nuclear weapons no longer threaten all humanity. Is there positive news in Congress, or are most of them just going along to get along with because so much of the economy is built on military spending with this R&D and all of that? Can you address that?
Well, I think it's a complicated, mix when it comes to Congress, right? So I would say, on the one hand, like I said earlier, the disappointing part about the recent Senate vote on defense spending, which ended up being that basically the entirety of the Senate Armed Services Committee, both Republicans and Democrats on that committee, almost unanimously voted to increase Pentagon spending, right? So on that front, there's a bipartisan consensus, at least in the Senate, that there needs to be more spending and more posturing towards a potential conflict. On the other hand, this letter that you referenced is a great example that there is a coalition of very concerned congresspeople, both in the House and in the Senate. There is a history, on top of that, there's a history of, last year under the Trump administration, there were efforts to reduce the Pentagon budget by 10%, right? So there are voices in Congress who are fighting to go the other direction than where we're on a path towards right now. The problem is, the influence of each of those camps are very different, right? So at the end of the day, the House Armed Services Committee, the Senate Armed Services Committee, those really are the players who decide what our posturing and what our defense spending, is going to look like. And I would say equally so, House Energy and Water for nuclear weapons, right? These are the people who are making decisions about where we're going to spend money and how many nuclear weapons we're going to have and how big our military is going to be built up. So if that camp that is against, this buildup is not involved in those committees, and oftentimes they're not put on those committees for that exact reason, right, that they go against the status quo. If they don't have the same level of influence, then obviously it's a pretty one-sided debate, even if a debate happens. Now, the encouraging thing is the debate is happening. And for a long time, I would say massive amounts of Pentagon spending and nuclear weapons spending would simply fly through the radars of the budget really without getting any press coverage at all, right, which was horrible for advocates in this movement. Now what we're seeing is that the progressives in Congress, along with, I think, some other Democrats who are looking at the world going towards a Cold War again, who maybe lived through the last Cold War, are finally saying, no, we do need to have a discussion about this if we're going in this direction. Yes, I understand there might be things in the world to be intimidated by, but going down this path might not be the answer. As you said, I think even the nature of war, whether it be on cyber front, whether it be on the trade front, the nature of war is different, right? And I think there's a recognition that even if we're going to spend all that money, spending it all towards an old model of operating in the world, like the Cold War model of tying ourselves to nuclear devastation, might not be the way to do it. So I think it's a question of what do we have to do to make sure that the champions that already exist in Congress feel supported, right, feel validated for making this an issue that they care deeply about. And then I think further in the medium to longer term, how do we get those voices in these committees that have all the power, right? And how do we make it clear that we want them to have as much of a say on what we do as a country as the hardliner and hawk voices in Congress currently have?
Right, exactly. And the Senate Armed Services Subcommittee on Strategic Forces is four white men.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
Ellen Hester, my last question is for you, please, it's not really a question, but tell us about the Friends Committee on National Legislation. I'm looking at the Washington newsletter from May, June, and the important articles there about much of what you've already covered today about change in the U.S. nuclear policy, finding our voices, and many other articles, Quakers aligning with the nuclear treaty. Mm-hmm. How can people get involved and know more get the guidance that you guys offer?
Well, first, I'd encourage everyone to go check out FCNL.org. There you'll really get introduced to the wide array of issues that we as an organization work on, and that spans both foreign policy issues, which is where my issues, Pentagon spending and nuclear weapons disarmament, fit into. But we also have a wide array of domestic issues that we work on, and we definitely see these issues as intersectional, right? We see how spending on war impacts the priorities that we have on domestic spending, right? So I would encourage everyone to go check out our website, and I think there you'll be able to go into the nuclear weapons and Pentagon spending and militarism tabs of the website and not only see, you know, our fact sheets and information on these new and modernized weapons that you referenced earlier, but I think also some solid guidance on how to go to your congressperson and make it clear that you have a problem with the status quo. You know, the biggest thing you can do is go to the website, figure out the messaging, become familiar with it, and go to your congressperson and say, I am going against the consensus that is being sold, or what's being sold as consensus in Congress, that Cold War thinking and preparing for some kind of conflict with a nuclear armed state is a consensus. Because I think the biggest thing that we need to recognize is that the American people do not want to go to war, right? And regardless of what Washington think tanks or what Congress people's rhetoric is towards war, the American people are generally unsupportive of endless wars, and we need to make that very clear. And I think every person that listens in can go to their individual representative and make it clear that they are not part of the consensus that is being sold in Washington right now.
I want to thank you, Alan Hester, for being with me on the Peace and Justice program today. I really appreciated everything you said, and I will refer people to your work. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. Okay, the end of another Peace and Justice program. Stay tuned for Playing Dead. I want to make one announcement. There will be a bell-ringing ceremony to honor Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We will gather again in an annual bell-ringing ceremony in commemoration of the atomic bombings and the lives lost, including the humans, insects, plants, rock, soil, air, and animals. Please join us by the creek on Sunday morning on August 8th at 10 a.m. to be in mindfulness of the past and the current world we live in. Meet at the 1 mile bridge and we'll walk to the spot together. Bring a bell or a chair, drinking water, and your essence. And I'd like to thank our underwriters once again for supporting this program and all those programs on KZFR. Don't forget to vote for them. I'm Best of Chico on the News and Review. We want to thank Tires Plus, Complete Auto Repair, offering Cooper and Michelin tires as well as oil changes, air conditioning services, repairs, and maintenance. Tires Plus also installs trailer brakes, custom suspension, lift and lower kits, winches, and custom bumpers on the corner of 6th Street and Broadway in Chico. Open 8:30 to 5 Monday through Saturday. Find Tires Plus on Facebook or at tirespluschico.com, or you can call them at 342-8338. Also want to thank Square Deal Mattress Factory, building the best night's sleep since 1920. Square Deal is celebrating over 100 years of making mattresses, bedding, furniture, and now face masks with the fabric of your choice right here in Chico. Square Deal is located at 1354 Humboldt Avenue. More details, see squaredealmattress.com. And I'm going to turn you now to the community calendar. I hope you all stay safe and well and that you're... can handle the stress of these times. Peace to you all.
Hey, listeners. It's time for the KZFR 90.1 FM Community Calendar with me, Megan Hammer. Saturday, August 7th, the Cohasset Community Association is thrilled to be hosting the 51st and 50th Annual Bazaar and Music Festival. After canceling last year's event, they're making up for the lost time. The Cohasset Community Association is a 501c nonprofit organization, and 100% of the profit benefits their community center. The event is $5 admission, and it goes from 9 a.m. until 7 p.m. It includes live music, a parade, rummage sale, craft vendors, a kids zone, raffle prizes, as well as a bake sale, a photo booth, and beer and wine. Also, August 7th, between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m., you can cool off at the Red Bluff Community Center, located at 1500 South Jackson Street in Red Bluff, California, at the Sizzling Summer Spectacular Craft and Vendor Fair. Check out all the amazing artisans and vendors who will be there. Don't forget to come hungry. If you have an event you'd like on the community calendar, let me know by sending us an email at cc@kzfr.org. This is the KZFR 90.1 FM Community Calendar.
All righty. And it is that time of day again here on another Friday afternoon on the Mighty Zephyr. Thanks for tuning in. My name's Ray. I'll be your host today on Playing Dead. Music of the Grateful Dead every Friday afternoon from 1 to 3. If you haven't been to the Playing Dead Facebook page, I invite you to join us there, Playing Dead on KZFR. I put up the set list, some nice photos, and give us a like, get a shout out. We'd love to see that, especially people that are all over the country, all over the world. We love sharing that and sharing this music that we have loved for so many years. And if you're new to it, man, I'm excited for you because it'll take you places you've never been. Alrighty, let's thank our underwriters, and we'll get right to the